is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you live. Pardon the noise in the background. I'm live from the Families USA Radio Row. We are literally right across the street from the United States Supreme Court. And we're going to, throughout the next 3 hours, have a series of interesting guests to come on and talk about the state of health care and other issues here in the United States. We'll also be taking your calls. I believe, let me just take a quick look here, that, yep, sure enough, there it is. I can put calls on the air here from this computer, which is a really cool thing. And so we'll also sort of declare it, and anything goes, what is it, Tuesday? I wanted to start out with an amazing story in today's New York Times. I mentioned Hunter's school yesterday, and things are tight, but fine. But that's a primary school, and this problem of for-profit colleges is like really eating up America. I mean, we've got now 1.1 going on $1.2 trillion. Going from 0.1 to 0.2 trillion is like $100 billion. We're going on $1.2 trillion, $1,200 billion, $1,200 billion in student loan debt. Where's that money going? Well, it turns out there's this guy named Arthur Kaiser. I'm assuming it's K-E-I-S-E-R. Maybe it's Kaiser. But he, back in 1998, bought a small Florida college and has basically built an empire. He's got 20,000 students at Kaiser University, spread over 15 campuses, and created this for-profit college. Well, now they're starting to crack down on for-profit colleges all across the United States. You know, the Obama administration is getting really serious about this. They're quite PO'd about how these for-profit colleges are making promises to people. You know, we talked yesterday about the 15 students out in California, I believe it is, who are refusing, or maybe it's Arizona, who are refusing to pay their student loans to, you know, one of these private colleges that basically ripped them off, made all kinds of promises to them. So, actually, according to, I believe it's the Department of Justice, lied to them, told them that there were jobs available when they were scam jobs. And, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff. So, but anyhow, here's the slick trick that this guy does. He's got this for-profit college. It's spinning off so much money. They've got their own private plane for their senior executives. They've got the property. They've got all kinds of stuff. But being not-for-profit works so much better as a college in the United States right now because of the changes that the Obama administration is making, so that, you know, there'll be fewer ripping off for-profit colleges. So what do these guys do? According to Patricia Cohen, writing in today's New York Times, the headline, "Some Owners of Private Colleges Turn a Tidy Profit by Going Nonprofit." What this guy did is he took the college, flipped it not-for-profit, but in his own for-profit portfolio, he kept the property and the plane. So he's now paying himself a salary of $856,000, or at least that's what it was in 2012, the last time that there are tax returns available. So the guy's making more than the president of Harvard University. Got that? And he's getting payments, and the way that he took this not-for-profit college for profit was by loaning the not-for-profit $321 million that it would then pay back to him with interest. Now, it doesn't specify the interest rate, but I'm guessing it's better than the 1.5% or 2% you get on Treasury bills right now, right? And it's better than the negative returns that most people are getting in the marketplace. So he's got a sweet deal. He's got a guaranteed income. So his not-for-profit college is paying him $321 million on basically the money that he put in to create a leverage buyout of his own school, right? He's doing Mitt Romney on himself. In addition to that, he owns the property, and the college is paying him $14 million a year for rent. Plus, he owns a Holiday Inn where the employees for the college stay, and he's got this plane. And the New York Times notes, or Patricia Cohen in today's New York Times notes, and a family member also has an ownership interest in the computer company that the college uses. This is a scam. It's a scam. I mean, I've been on the board of a private school. No, it's not a college, granted, but I've been on the board of a private school for 35 years. And I have never enriched myself to the tune of a penny from doing that. I mean, we don't even, board members don't even get reimbursed for travel expenses or for phone calls. I mean, you know, we get nothing. It's a volunteer thing. This is how most schools, not-for-profit schools in the country, run. Is, you know, their board of directors dance their hearts out. The people at the schools are underpaid. They work really hard. Not so with these for-profit colleges. And then when they get in trouble for being for-profit, they flip themselves not-for-profit, but they do it in a way that they're just constantly, you know, pumping money into themselves. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Kaiser, he is the House Republicans' appointee to the Education Department panel that oversees accreditation of colleges. House Republicans love this. Hey, you know, you can take the commons and you can turn it into a profit-making thing. How cool is that? Right? I mean, that's the you know, the Republican worldview on everything, is figure out a way to steal money from somebody, or to take money from somebody, or skim money off the top, or scam money, or, you know, whatever. For-profit colleges, by the way, receive this again from the New York Times. For-profit colleges receive roughly $30 billion a year. That's $30,000 million a year in taxpayer-funded student aid. Corinthian Colleges is the one where they've got 15 students now who are refusing to pay them back. Giant for-profit chain Corinthian Colleges, which once took $1.4 billion a year in taxpayer funds, has virtually collapsed after a series of state and federal inquiries and lawsuits. She notes in the New York Times, for-profit schools vigorously oppose the newest rules, arguing that they would ruin institutions that serve students who have few other educational options. In other words, hey, you know, they're saying, we're ripping off the poor people, just leave us alone and let us do it. And the Obama administration is saying, no, we really don't want you ripping off the poor people anymore. So anyway, I wanted to point that out. It's, in my mind, a really big deal. A big deal story. So, Joe in Gordonsville, Virginia, you had a question about hemp milk, Joe? Joe? You are on the air. I can't hear Joe. Let's try John and see if John can hear me. John in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Can you hear me, John?
Yeah, Tom, I can hear you.
Okay, great. We got just a minute here. Quick one.
Just going to talk to you about the ACA. I was going to get your thought on what the Supreme Court are fixing to overturn the ACA. What's your thought on that?
The Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court? What about it?
I'm just going to get your thought on them fixing to overturn the...
Hang on just a second, John. Shane, you got to crank up his gain. I can't hear what's going on here. Go ahead.
Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, I was just going to get your thought on the Supreme Court case tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Your thought of them overturning the ACA.
Yeah, well, you know, it's going to take a few months before they come down with their decision, but we'll know a lot based on what kind of questions they ask tomorrow. So Shano is going to be there in the Supreme Court, and we will have a report on it tomorrow afternoon on the program. So just stick around, John. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. We will be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Live from the Families USA Radio Row here in Washington, D.C., right across the street from the U.S. Supreme Court. No, we're going down the other way. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Families USA Radio Row. And, boy, Bill Bratton, the head of New York City Police, has got an outrageous one. We'll get to that in just a second. But right now, Ron Pollack is here with us. He is the director, founding executive director of Families USA. FamiliesUSA.org is the website. And Ron, welcome to the program.
Always great to see you. Thanks.
It's great to see you, too. Let me turn you up here. There we go. Say something.
Yeah, it's great to see
you. That works better. That works a whole lot. So tell me, what's Families USA doing? What in general and with this Radio Row today?
So first of all, we've organized Radio Row, and we're so thrilled that you've come here. And the idea is to try to make sure that the stakes of this lawsuit are understood by the public. Now, we are flying in dozens of people from across the country. These are people who are in the states where the states have so far refused to set up these marketplaces, and the federal government is doing it in its place. And if subsidies are withdrawn, these people are going to find health insurance unaffordable. They'll rejoin the ranks of the uninsured. And many of the people who we're bringing in are people who've got major health problems, and their health and lives will truly be at risk. Tomorrow morning, we will have the folks who are flying in standing in front of the court, and they will tell their own stories. Now, obviously, they can't do it inside the courtroom, but at least we hope to make sure that the public understands what the stakes are.
Hasn't the court declared that while all federal property in Washington, D.C. is essentially a free speech zone, the Supreme Court is the exception to that? They can arrest you for having a demonstration out in front of the Supreme Court? Or
well,
are you going to do it on the street in front?
We have permits.
Okay.
So you have to get a permit, and we do have a permit. And we'll be just in front of the steps of the Supreme Court, and that's perfectly appropriate. Nobody's going to get arrested.
You know, and I think you and I have had this conversation before. I discovered this when I was writing which book? I think it was my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It was about maybe 5 years ago. That Robert Ball, who wrote principally, was the principal writer of the Medicare legislation in the 60s in the Johnson administration, and was close friends with Lyndon Johnson, is on the record. I mean, he's deceased now, but is on the record having said that when they wrote that Medicare legislation, their plan, they put this thing into place so that at some point in the future, and they expected it would happen probably in the administration of the president following Johnson, assuming it was a Democrat, that at any point in the future, they could simply drop the eligibility age for Medicare by a decade every couple of years to, you know, and take a couple of years for them to swallow that python, you know, or that rabbit going through the python, you know, to add it, you know, to bring ramp up their administrators until it was at zero. And now you've got a national single-payer health care system. Is there any way to bring that message out? Is that an alternative to what's going on? I mean, if the Supreme Court takes down Obamacare, is it time for us to start talking seriously about we already have a single-payer system in this country? It works. It's going to be in trouble, or it's going to have some challenges, let's say. As one of your colleagues was telling me this morning, you know, the growth of Alzheimer's and the aging boomers, bring everybody into it. It's solvent forever.
Well, it's a solution that could work. But politically, I have my doubts as to whether that's going to happen.
Well, with this Congress.
With this Congress, and we could not have passed that in 2010 when the Affordable Care Act was enacted into law. We actually had hoped that at least there would be some alternative, like a public plan option, that people could choose. But even that would not have passed. There were too many folks who ultimately, whose vote we got, but we wouldn't have gotten it with a public plan option, and that's why it had to be dropped.
Right.
So, I love Bob Ball, and he really played such a pioneering role with respect to health care in this country.
Did you know him?
I knew him very well.
Wow.
Have I
mischaracterized him, or is that a...
No, I think Bob would very much say that the Medicare program potentially provided a model as to how we could provide health care across the country. And having a system of Medicare for everybody clearly would make sense. It's the politics, and I don't think we're likely to see that, at least for quite a long time.
Yeah, in part because money has such a stranglehold on politics in the United States as a consequence of other stupid decisions by right-wingers on the Supreme Court. You know, Buckley in 76, First National Bank in 77, Citizens United, McCutcheon, I mean...
Gore v. Bush?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it was Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
Bush initiated that lawsuit.
You're right.
And saying that he would be irreparably harmed if they counted the vote in Florida. That should have told us everything.
Well, actually, it's very interesting because I've heard stories about what was happening in the last moments of this. And the Democratic side that was watching the tallying of the votes felt momentarily there was going to be a change with Gore on top.
Right.
And so there was this rush to make sure that the voting would stop, the vote counting would stop.
Right, yeah. And in fact, when the Supreme Court counted them a year later, I mean, they buried it in the 17th paragraph of an article, the Arthur Schlesinger? Yeah, whoever the editor of the New York Times was, you know, he said the reason why we buried the fact that when we counted recounted the vote in Florida, Al Gore won, no matter what metric you used, unless the metric you used was only those three counties where Al Gore originally wanted to sue, then he would have still lost. But if you count the whole state, no matter what, Gore won. But they buried it in the 17th paragraph because it was a month after 9/11. Yeah. They didn't want to diminish the authority of President Bush during a time of national crisis.
Well,
anyhow, we've wandered far afield.
No, you know, but it's really interesting that we're talking about it. When the Supreme Court decided to take this case, King v. Burwell,
right.
Woman who wrote for the New York Times for about 25 years as the Supreme Court reporter, Linda Greenhouse,
right.
wrote a column, and it was a very interesting column. And what she said was that when the court decided to take this case, one of her colleagues, she's now at Yale Law School, said, "This is Bush v. Gore all over again." And she said, "No, it's not. It's worse than that."
Right.
You know, that there is no reason that the court has taken this. There's no constitutional issue here. There's no conflict between the circuits. And two of the circuits already had scheduled oral argument, and the Supreme Court leapfrogged that.
Amazing. Bad news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Ron Pollack, the founding director of Families USA, familiesusa.org. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, delighted to be with you again.
Great to have you with us. Welcome back from Washington, D.C. Tom Hartman here with you at the Families USA Conference, right across the street from the United States Supreme Court. And we are having a fine time. I mentioned Bill Bratton and all this stuff. I wanted to just share a little more perspective or insight or thoughts or whatever on this. Bill Bratton, you know, is a very old guy who's the head of the New York Police Department. And there were 9 more homicides in January and February than a year ago. And in a lot of those homicides, in fact, according to Bill Bratton, in all 9 of them, there were 54 in the first 2 months of 2015 compared to 45 the year before. In all 9 of them, they found some pot on the scene. So, therefore, these homicides were over this seemingly innocent drug, marijuana. In fact, this is, you know, he says, in this city, people are killing each other over marijuana more so than anything that we've had to deal with in the 80s and 90s with heroin and cocaine. In some instances, it's a causal factor. So, in other words, pot is causing people to kill each other. Bill, respectfully, it's not pot causing people to kill each other. It's pot being illegal. When things are illegal, criminals deal in them if there's a market for them. And when criminals deal in them, they sometimes guns get involved. I mean, this is just like the most stupid argument. It's like saying that, Dillinger and Joe Kennedy's fortune were not the result of alcohol prohibition. You know, I mean, come on. We know what's really going on here. So, anyhow, that's something I wanted to point out. We're going to pick up your calls in a few minutes, but right now, Senator Sherrod Brown is dropping by. Let me move the camera over here so you can see him as well. Senator Brown.
Good to be back.
Nice
Thank
to
you.
See
sometimes
you.
On the phone, sometimes
in
your
person.
Studio, and sometimes wherever we are now.
Indeed,
across from the
indeed.
Capitol.
And our studio is new and improved. So
new
next time
and
you
improved.
Drop by, it's yeah. It
was already so modern and nice.
Yeah, it's very comfortable.
It's plush and yes.
Yeah.
By the way, I saw your friend Sheldon Adelson today in the gallery.
Oh, really?
Sitting right almost next to Newt Gingrich.
Oh, he's here for
the Netanyahu speeches,
yeah.
Of course. This in the front row.
Yeah, amazing. The first time in 200 years a foreign leader has come to speak to Congress to disrespect a president. I'm astonished.
The problem with you, Tom, is you tend to know history, and you're not welcome in this city when you point historical facts at historical
context. This literally has not happened since the George Washington administration. Anyhow, we're here.
Didn't King George speak at a joint session of Congress when he was on the ballot?
That's
I think you're forgetting that.
That's right. Yeah.
Or he wasn't on the ballot.
No, it was when Alexander Hamilton invited him over during the Jefferson administration. Yeah, I mean, it's just, can you imagine? Anyway.
I can't imagine. I know how this crowd operates, but go ahead.
Yeah, so what's on your mind right now? What's at the top of your agenda?
A young man named Jermaine Cook from Cleveland Heights, not far from where my wife and I live in Cleveland, is coming to see me this afternoon. He is early 30s. He has health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. He and a quarter million others can lose their insurance, and if the court does this badly, and you know, I can't get out of my mind this court and the Republicans in the House that repeatedly vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They're all enjoying, virtually all of them are enjoying good health insurance paid for by taxpayers, but they really want to deny it to others, and it's pretty shameful.
That's an excellent point. You know, virtually all of these guys who are on a Jeremiah.
But they've earned it in their minds. They've earned this health insurance.
Right. They're either government employees or they're billionaires who are sponsoring Tea Partiers and whatnot, and they've got no problem with health insurance.
It really is the unrelenting attacks on this, attacks on the president personally, but the attacks on the most important handiwork he's done, frankly, is the Affordable Care Act, I think, and that I've done in the last 10 years. And it's in my state, 700,000 people have insurance that did not have it 5 years ago. 1 million seniors have gotten benefits on preventive care that didn't have them 5 years ago. 100,000 young people are on their parents' plans that weren't 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And these consumer protections we build in so that insurance companies can't take a walk. If you cost too much, you get too sick and you cost them too much.
Right. This is all great stuff. And if the Supreme Court takes down the Affordable Care Act, for the Republicans, aren't they kind of going to find themselves in the position of the dog who finally caught the bumper on the car?
Here you go, speaking in historical terms again. The famous dog that eventually that finally caught the car. Right. Well, I think they are. I mean,
Harry Truman tell a joke about that, actually.
Or he said, if you want a friend in Washington, you get a dog.
Yeah, that's right.
He did
a lot of dog
jokes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, I don't know. I mean, they said repeal and replace so many times ad nauseum that I don't think they've really ever thought much about a replace. But when a quarter million people in my state alone lose their insurance, if the court rules in the wrong way, they're going to have to explain it. That doesn't mean they'll do anything, and that's what concerns me so much, that I don't know what happens to these quarter million people. Surely they'll have a break in their coverage, and, you know, a kid gets sick, they lose whatever can happen to families and
emergency
health situations. More bankruptcies, all that happened, all that we've seen happen for 50 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. Might it be a good time to start talking about alternatives, like, for example, what Robert Ball, the guy who wrote the Medicare bill back in the 60s, is on the record saying, it's in one of my books, Rebooting the American Dream, that they put Medicare together in a way and with the assumption that a future president or a future Congress would simply start lowering the eligibility age by a decade every couple of years, giving a couple of years for the bureaucracy to absorb that many new enrollees. And until eventually the eligibility age for Medicare was zero.
Yeah, which I think would be terrific. You may remember, Tom, because we talked during this process. I had written a provision in the Affordable Care Act to bring Medicare and a couple others to bring Medicare eligibility to 55, which was what Mr. Ball came. You know, one of the things he suggested then, and President Clinton worked on it 20 years ago. And we thought we had that vote, and Senator Lieberman changed his mind. We couldn't get the 60th vote then. But ideally, that's where we go with this, that Medicare has worked for people over 65. There are, of course, problems, but it's worked. Why not at some point Medicare for the whole country? It's simpler. It's easier to explain. It's easier to understand. It's better with cost containment. And most importantly, it gives everybody an understandable, comprehensive health insurance.
Yeah, and most Americans, you say single-payer health care, and they don't know what you're talking about. You say Medicare, they immediately know what you're talking about.
Exactly right.
And you know, John Conyers, House Bill, 676?
Which he's done repeatedly,
year after year after year. But that's sort of an instant Medicare for All. It's right. More of a phased-in thing. I don't know. I mean, is the Democratic caucus saying here's Plan B?
I don't think the Democratic caucus wants to go there yet any more than the administration does, because I think most people think we'll win in the court. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I have no idea. But if we don't, we need to assess quickly and how to do this. I still don't think with all this that we could get all of our caucus to be for Medicare for All, as much sense as that makes, even though they were willing to vote for it during the Affordable Care Act. That was part of something bigger. I'm not sure that we could put the votes together now, even though I think that may be inevitable in the next 10 or 20 years. It's just the most explainable, most easiest to administer of any of the ways of putting together comprehensive health insurance.
And using the language of William F. Buckley, it's the most conservative option. It's the least expensive. It's the least complex. It's the most transparent.
Yeah, it's all those things. You bet.
I mean, it seems pretty straightforward stuff. So anyhow, where'd my clock go? I've lost. Oh, here we are, 2:42. We got 3 minutes until the break, unless you've got a boogie.
No, fine.
What other things are on your schedule? What are you looking at that? There's a whole bunch of issues facing this country.
So earned income tax credit extension is really, really important, as is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Both are government sort of partnerships that reward work. The earned income tax credit, people that make $30,000 or $40,000 a year get a break in their taxes of $2,000 or $3,000.
These are expiring?
Well, the expansion is expiring that we did during the Affordable Care.
Because it was done by reconciliation.
Right. And it was done during the Recovery Act, actually, during that, not the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
The Children's Health Insurance Program, the funding runs out this fall. In my state alone, it's 130,000 children. And again, these are sons and daughters of families who have jobs but don't make enough, or their employer doesn't provide insurance and they don't make enough to afford it.
Isn't that an essential cancer in our body economic the contract that we used to have, the government of the United States used to have with its people, was work hard, put in 40 hours a week, keep your nose clean, you can raise a family.
Yeah.
Can't do it anymore.
Well, minimum wage is worth a third less than it was 40 years ago. All of that, insurance, health insurance, pension, income levels, all have eroded. And it's all sort of it's a group of people that are far too vulnerable, and we've let that happen. And we've got it. Government's got a partner in making that better.
Right. So this needs to be like at the top of the list.
This is what we ought to be doing this year, absolutely, at a minimum.
Back to the Clinton's internal slogan, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
Our economy is not serving our people, our healthcare system is not serving our people, and we need to pull these things together.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Boy, I wish you the very best, Senator Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com, and brown.house.com.
Senate.gov.
Sorry, I just demoted you.
Thanks, Tom.
My apologies. Great to see you. Senator Sherrod Brown,
thank
you so much for joining us today. We'll be back in just a few minutes here, live from the Families USA Conference in Washington, D.C., right across the street from the Supreme Court building. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me. And Dr. Alice Chen is here. She is the executive director of Doctors for America. She's a practicing internal medicine hospitalist and an assistant clinical professor at UCLA, drsforamerica.org, as in Doctors for America, foramerica.org is the website. And Dr. Chen, welcome. It's nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's
nice
great
to meet
be
you.
Here.
Tell me about yourself and about your organization.
Sure. So I'm a doctor. I take care of patients. And at some point when I was taking care of patients, I realized that too many of them couldn't get the care they needed, so I became a part of this organization. of thousands of doctors and medical students across the country who believe that we need to put patients over politics and make sure everyone has access to health care.
That is great. Doctors for America, when did it start? Where is it based? What do you all do?
Sure. So Doctors for America was started in 2009, and we have 16,000 doctors and medical students in all 50 states.
Really?
Exactly.
Wow. What kind of membership does the AMA have?
It's somewhere around 200 or something.
Oh, it's 200,000.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's a lot more doctors than I realized.
There are a lot of us.
Yeah.
But we have 16,000 active doctors who are working to try to get our patients the care they need.
That is spectacular. And what are the principal areas that you're working in? What do you see as the pressure points that are worthy of effort to produce the kind of results that you're trying to achieve?
So certainly having access to health insurance is a really important one, which is why we're here at the Supreme Court, why we're bringing in doctors from around the country, or they're coming in on their own to be at the Supreme Court and make sure that people keep the insurance that they
have. So you're getting ready for tomorrow for the oral arguments in King v. Burwell.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And go ahead.
We just thinking about the fact that 8 million people's health insurance is at risk.
Yeah.
We can't let that happen.
Yeah. In fact, the latest, I was just looking at the Think Progress website, and I think the latest number that they were talking about, the numbers that explain Obamacare and what would happen, and it's really pretty startling. 34 states will be left scrambling. 13 million Americans will lose access to health insurance, according to them.
Mm-hmm.
Premiums could increase up to 774%.
Mm-hmm.
8 million more Americans go uninsured. 71% of people already disagree with the Supreme Court doing this. This is nuts.
This is
how not only has partisan politics contaminated by corporate interest devastated our legislative branches in both the federal and state houses all over the country, in my opinion, as a result of a series of Supreme Court decisions over the last 40 years saying that money is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution.
Cool.
And, you know, not only is that happening, but it's like the Supreme Court now has become politically corrupted. I've read this argument, and I cannot find any rational legal basis for it.
Exactly. And you ask Democrats and Republicans alike in these 34 states that didn't set up their own exchanges, nobody thought that they couldn't get tax credits.
Right. And some of them tried. I mean, Oregon set up an exchange, and, you know, they just hired the wrong company to do it. And
exactly.
It didn't work all that well, and they said, forget it. We'll go with the national exchange. But
exactly.
This is it's really quite extraordinary. Does Doctors for America have any specific policy prescriptions, or are you just you're right now you're just fighting to King v. Burwell, basically?
We're fighting King v. Burwell. We're also trying to make sure that all those states that have not expanded Medicaid, that they expand Medicaid.
How many are there now?
There are, let's see, 28 states have done
20,
it. So
that would be 32 that haven't. No.
22.
Yeah, you do math better than me.
So we've got math on the fly.
Right, there you go. So it's good for titration and things. So we've got 22 states where people still can go bankrupt because they get sick. Where they, you know, and these are almost exclusively working people. Because in those 22 states, if you're not working, you actually qualify for state-based Medicaid. If you're genuinely poor and have no income, but as soon as you make over $3,000 or $4,000 a year, you're no longer eligible for the state Medicaid, and you're making too little for the Obamacare subsidy. I mean, this is the damage that John Roberts did to Obamacare the last time the Supreme Court heard this case.
Exactly. Enough is enough.
Yeah.
We need to get people care.
I agree. Well said. So is Doctors for America presenting at the Supreme Court tomorrow, or are you just presenting it? Not just. Are you presenting in front of the Supreme Court?
In front of the Supreme Court.
That's
great. We are going to be there in our white coats to speak on behalf of our patients who couldn't be here.
That is marvelous. We're talking with Dr. Alice Chen, the Executive Director of Doctors for America. The website is drsforamerica.org. And what do you think is the status of single payer in the United States right now?
I think we're pretty far off from it.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at what's happening with the Affordable Care Act, which is it's a much milder version.
Oh, yeah. It's basically what Richard Nixon proposed in 1971. I mean, it's an old Republican idea, actually, which is so strange. I mean, it's what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Oh, my. So, on the other hand, if the Supreme Court takes out Obamacare, does that open an opportunity? I mean, the country is... been listening to this conversation for a long time. The majority of Americans, 71% of Americans, think the Supreme Court should not destroy Obamacare. That would imply some support for the idea of national health care.
You know, honestly, I don't think it's worth risking. Because somebody who has cancer and is on chemotherapy is going to lose their health insurance and they're going to die.
Yeah.
And I'm just not willing to take that risk.
Right. Or somebody who's got a family member that gets sick or even just gets in a car accident and they don't have insurance. And they may not die, but they may be paying for it for the rest of their lives. They may be bankrupt. They may lose their jobs. They may lose their homes. I had a fascinating moment. I was in Denmark. We did this show from Copenhagen a couple of years ago. And I had the head... right-wing politician, the most conservative politician from the parliament on. And I said, so you're a conservative? He's like, yeah, I'm a conservative. I said, so that means you want to do away with the Danish national health care system. And he said, what, are you crazy? I couldn't find a single, conservative there meant that they were against immigrants. I mean, that was pretty much it, That was amazing. Anyhow, Alice Chen, you're doing God's work. Thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you
it's
so much,
very
Tom.
Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
And the website, check it out, please. DRS, as in doctors, for, F-O-R, America, doctors for America, DRS, for America. .org. Got it right?
Yep.
Great.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank
we'll
you.
Be back in the next hour. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we are live from the Families USA Radio Row, literally right across the street from the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. Everybody from Families USA, the Radio Row is going on today and tomorrow. We'll be bringing some guests in by telephone tomorrow. And they're getting ready for tomorrow's Supreme Court case for the arguments in King v. Burwell. This is the case where the right-wingers are claiming that because there is one sentence in the law, I mean, repeatedly throughout the Affordable Care Act, through the Obamacare legislation, repeatedly throughout the legislation, it states that the purpose of the legislation is to provide affordable health care to everybody in the United States. I mean, over and over and over again. In fact, that's in the preamble. It's part of essentially the title of the act. It's everywhere. And the Supreme Court, on many occasions, I mean, going back a century, has always said when you consider a challenge to a law or a challenge of a law or a challenge based on a law, you have to consider the challenge or the piece of the law that is being challenged in the context of the larger issue, in the context of the larger law. And in this law, there was... the sentence that says that, where they were talking about providing subsidies to people, they said, people who buy their health insurance through exchanges set up by the state are eligible for subsidies. Well, what they meant was that, the assumption was the states were all going to set up exchanges. Basically it was their way of saying you qualify for a subsidy if you buy it through an exchange. You don't qualify for a subsidy if, you know, you're David Koch and you just go out and buy it yourself, right? If your employer provides it to you, or if you're independently wealthy or whatever. But one of these conservative right-wing whack jobs has come up with this idea that, hey, we can take down the entire law by pointing out that there's one sentence that was awkwardly constructed in it. And what's bizarre, genuinely bizarre, is that the Supreme Court said, we'll think about that. I mean, it's just bizarre. So, anyhow, we're going to have guests throughout the 3 hours here at 20 and 45. And in the meantime, I will be taking your calls and offering my rants and thoughts. Bibi Netanyahu just finished speaking before, finished a little while ago, speaking before the United States Congress, the assembled delegates of the House and Senate. This is the first time in the history of the United States, to the best of my knowledge. I've seen several places it published first time in 200 years, but this country has a history that's more than 200 years long, and I cannot imagine, you know, in the first 30 years of the Republic, George Washington or John Adams or Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or James Monroe or Old Hickory, what was Old Hickory's name? With the hair. Anyhow, the guy who followed Monroe, Andrew Jackson, as I recall. Anyhow, I can't imagine any of them inviting, you know, the president of France to come over and trash the president, or the Polk administration when he was going to war with Mexico. If the Whigs had invited, I don't think Polk was Polk a Whig? Was he our only Whig president? I'd have to go back and look. But in any case, the opposition party, whether it was the Whigs or whether it was the Democratic Republican, by that point in time, they were called the Democrats, inviting, say, the president of El Salvador or Nicaragua or something like that to come in and give a speech against our going to war with Mexico to grab, essentially, parts of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and Southern California. It's unimaginable, and yet it just happened. I mean, unimaginable, and yet it just happened. I'm just astonished. Anyhow, Keith in Rose Hill, Mississippi. Keith?
Landrum, South Carolina. Tom, how you doing today?
Oh, okay. Hey, how you doing? I'm well, Keith. What's up?
Right. In this ACA decision, I fail to see how the Chevron decision does not apply. This is Chevron versus the Natural Resources Defense Council, a 1984 decision.
Right.
You look it up on Wikipedia, and under the holding, it gives a quote, "The court, in the opinion of Justice John Paul Stevens, upheld the EPA's interpretation. A two-part analysis was born in Chevron decision called the Chevron two-step. Reviewing, the court determines, one, first, always the question of whether Congress has directly spoken to the precise question at issue. If the intent of Congress is clear, then it's the end of matter. If the court, as well as the agency, must ambiguously express the content of Congress. And two, if the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to the specific question, the issue for the courts and the agency answer is best permissible construction of the status." So basically, this has to do with the intent of the law versus the wording of the law. And in
You're
this
right.
case, the intent of the law won.
You're right. And there is no disputing that the intent of the law was to provide affordable health insurance to every American. I mean, nobody can dispute that. And that's why I'm so astonished by the chutzpah of this court, the raw, naked partisanship, It's bizarre behavior, and
I agree, and I just saw this in 1984. So the court intends to overturn a Reagan era type regulation,
right? Or a Reagan era precedent, essentially. You know, and these are the guys who all of them, you know, Sam Alito and Scalia and John Roberts in particular, raised their hand in front of the Senate and said, oh, yeah, stare decisis. If we have established policy in the United States, we're just going to call balls and strikes. We're going to, you know, it's like we're arbiters. We're not changing laws. And he lied. John Roberts lied to us. Sam Alito lied to us. Scalia lied to us. Thomas lied to us.
Today, ask them about the Chevron decision and what they think about it.
Yeah, okay, I'll do it. Because the Chevron, you're absolutely right. The Chevron case is the most recent and the most visible case where the Supreme Court explicitly said it's not whether or not the words of the law were well written, because a lot of laws are badly written. It was what was the intent of the legislators when they wrote the law. It's not the Supreme Court's job to make law. It's Congress's job to make law. You're spot on. You're absolutely right, Keith. Thanks a lot for the call. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Oh, well, you were talking about colleges. I went to a private for-profit college up here in Hancock called Finlandia University. Mm-hmm. Way back in 91, I broke my neck in an auto accident, and
ouch.
I couldn't do physical labor anymore.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a lot of homes and institutions and thought I got a good brain. I might as well try to turn this around into something good and go to school to work with kids. Well, I got all the way up through my senior year. I'm dyslexic, too, and I guess I have ADD and a few other learning disabilities. They allowed me to dictate. Then they said in my senior year, halfway through it, that they had some kind of an audit. I never saw anything that really said that, but they said I wasn't allowed to dictate anymore, and I had to write a 30-plus page thesis or intern. Of course, they didn't have a place here to intern, so I said, well, I'll try the thesis, even though I never really wrote anything more than, say, 5 or 10 pages the whole time I was in college. And I just couldn't do it in the time that was allotted, and I didn't have the help anymore. And I was in their learning program that they were supposed to have to help people with disabilities. And I dropped out with 3 credits left to go for my BA and owing over $92,000.
Holy cow. So you got screwed to the tune of 92 grand by a private for-profit college. Is that the net of this?
Yep.
That's amazing. Rich, thanks for calling and sharing your story with us. I'm so sorry to hear your experience. I wish you the very best. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Live from Radio Row here with the Families USA, Dr. George's Benjamin is going to drop by in a few minutes, and we'll continue picking up your calls. Like a cheap suit is the phrase over at Daily Kos. This is fascinating. Boehner is going to allow a vote in the House of Representatives on the clean funding of the Department of Homeland Security, a clean bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security, which he's been all along saying he wouldn't do. And they're going to have that vote today. It's done under something called Title 22 of the House Rules, or you know, Section 22 or whatever it is, and Rule 22 is what it's called. And what that rule allows them to do is essentially say, okay, the House of Representatives passed a version of this legislation which also kneecapped the president's immigration policies, but it also funds the Department of Homeland Security. We sent it to the Senate. The Senate sent it back without the kneecap the president's immigration stuff attached to it. We don't have time to debate and vote on a new bill. We don't have time to go to a conference committee. So instead, we're simply going to hold a vote to reverse our last vote and accept the Senate's bill. So it's not like anybody in the House of Representatives is going to get stuck with the label of I'm the guy who proposed the clean bill. Right? It's not going to happen. And they're all going to be able to pretend that, oh, clean bill. I don't know what happened. And most importantly, because of all the furor over Bibi Netanyahu, John Boehner is going to be able to bury in the news cycle the fact that he just lost badly. I mean, he just lost badly. And he lost badly because he's listening to the Tea Partiers. At some point, John Boehner has to look around and say, you know, this Tea Party thing, this is a cancer in the American political system. It's a cancer that's funded by billionaires. It shouldn't, well, I'm not sure what Boehner should say about it, but increasingly he's just throwing bones basically to these guys. Meanwhile, Netanyahu gave his speech, and we'll see where that all goes. I've been looking for a good analysis of the speech. I was not able to watch it because I've been running around getting ready to come over here and do this Radio Row at Families USA, FamiliesUSA.org, by the way, the website. But remarkable. So anyhow, back to the phones, as they say in Radio Land. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Well, I would be failed in my duty as an American citizen if I'm going to talk about civics to lay out that, yes, Andrew Jackson was Old Hickory, and my office just happened to be a stone's throw from Old Hickory Boulevard.
Andrew Jackson.
Here in Nashville.
There you go. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Carl.
Yeah. It's been some disputes because, you know, the borders weren't quite as clear as it was as it is now between Carolina and Tennessee, where he was born, but he died here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I do believe he's buried here.
Oh, interesting.
At the Hermitage, which was his property.
Yeah, so you know the story.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But you wanted to call about Netanyahu.
You know, in being aware of civics, I've always been able to lie to myself as a huge fan of civics that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party has always been loyal oppositions of each other and not enemies.
Right.
As of today, that lie in my mind is shattered.
Yeah.
I'm furious beyond belief that this took place. And basically, the Republican Party has said to the Democratic Party, you're no longer a loyal opposition. You are enemies. And I believe that we need to take them at their word, that they are enemies, the Republican Party. They just are. It's sad to say that, and it's sad to admit that, because law opposition is much better. But over the past 6 years and this blatant treasonous move against our president, I've never seen anything like this. How the hell could they invite a president of another country in our house, in the people's house, the well of the people house? And
it has never happened in the history of this country, Carl.
Stand up and cheer for it.
Yeah.
I'm beyond.
I do not think this would happen.
I'm not surprised. I'm very disappointed.
Yeah, I don't think that the Republicans would have had the I lack a word for it, but whatever, to do this to any other president. The level of disrespect that is coming out of the Republican Party for President Obama is genuinely astonishing. And I can tell you a lot of people in this city in Washington, D.C. are just perpetually astonished by these guys. They didn't even tell him that they were negotiating with him. Boehner had a meeting with Obama after he'd nailed this meeting down, and he didn't even mention it. I mean, this is so wrong. We're going to be back in just a moment. Dr. George's Benjamin hopefully will be able to be with us. And stick around. We're doing our show live here from the Families USA Radio Row, familiesusa.com. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Dr. George's Benjamin will be with us, the executive director of the American Public Health System. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Radio Row, the FamiliesUSA.org Radio Row. And Dr. Georges Benjamin is with me, MD. He is known as one of the nation's most influential physician leaders. And he was the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, oversaw the expansion and improvement of that state's Medicaid program. He's a board-certified in internal medicine, fellow of the American College of Physicians, fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration, a fellow emeritus of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and an honorary fellow of the Royal Society of Public Health. His recent book, The Quest for Health Reform, A Satirical History, is an expose of the nearly 100-year quest to ensure quality, affordable health coverage through the use of political cartoons. How cool is that?
It is cool.
It is, yeah. It is a member of the Institute of Medicine and National Academies, and on it goes. Dr. Benjamin, it's a pleasure and honor to have you with us.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
So what are the issues before us right now?
Well, at the end of the day, the issue is whether or not we're going to continue to allow this health insurance premiums to be affordable for people that are buying them through the exchanges. And that's the real challenge. You know, the whole purpose of doing health reform in the first place was to make sure that health insurance was affordable.
We should add, normally you have a resonant voice.
Yeah.
You got a bit of a cold right now.
My voice is... Yeah, I've lost it today.
Yeah, that's remarkable. It's not often that I hear a voice that far gone. You must have been out there yelling at the Supreme Court all day yesterday.
Well, I'll be yelling all day tomorrow, that's for sure.
Yeah. So what's going on tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow is when they have their oral arguments.
Yeah, and King v. Burwell. Yeah.
And King v. Burwell. And as you know, they're going to be debating whether or not health insurance premiums assistance should occur in those exchanges that were established by the federal government.
Right.
And they're debating a very nuanced point of law, which most of us believe is something that should never got into court. Yeah. But here we are.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that the reason it got to court is because this court has abandoned traditional jurisprudence and become a political entity. They are behaving like political animals. It's crazy. I mean, there really is no basis for this lawsuit, and the idea that, you know, 13 million people could lose health insurance, health care, that you know, another 8 or 9, 10,000, depending on whose numbers you're using, people could die in the next year if the Supreme Court. I mean, I'm just astonished. I'm just astonished that they would even take this case.
Yeah, well, you know, they're arguing the law and not the health impact.
Right.
But they need to consider the health impact.
Yeah, yeah. This court, they remind me of the, I forget the name of the court, but, you know, the court that ruled that child labor laws were a violation of the right to contract, you know, back in 1913. The Lochner court, yeah. Thank you, Shana. It's just astonishing. So, Dr. Georges C. Benjamin is with us. And actually, where did my one sheet go? Here we go. Alpha.org, by the way, is the website for, is that the American Public Health System?
American Public Health Association.
Association. And tell us about the American Public Health Association.
We're a professional society of people interested and practitioners of public health. We're the oldest in the world. We've been around since 1872.
Wow.
Yeah. So we are really the history of public health in the United States, and we've been supporting universal health care for all Americans in terms of health insurance coverage for over 100 years.
So you wrote the book on the history of the effort to provide health care to all Americans. What does that history look like? What were the milestones? Were there any unexpected? I believe Teddy Roosevelt suggested a national health care system. I don't know about other presidents.
Well, it goes back to the 30s. And just certainly Teddy Roosevelt was very much one of the forefathers of that effort. What's important to know is that we've heard these arguments against universal coverage since the 1930s.
Yeah.
We said that, boy, if we start covering people, the world's going to come to an end and people will die. And we've heard that regardless of political administration, there's been health reform. And the truth of the matter is we've continued to cover people. We've continued to find innovative ways to get health insurance coverage for everybody. We're not quite there yet. But I can tell you that the world hasn't come to an end.
Right.
And doctors still have the autonomy to take care of their patients, and the economy has continued to grow.
Yeah, Yeah. So, you know, 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, we were hearing from Republicans that if the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, became law, that we would see hospitals crashing, we would see doctor practices going out of business, we would see, you know, people having to wait, you know, years to have, you know, that gangrenous foot removed or whatever. I mean, you know, it was just all these horror stories. What has been the consequence of the Affordable Care Act so far?
In the places that have not expanded the Medicaid program, for example, hospitals have begun to close.
Yeah.
But places that where the Affordable Care Act has been put in place and acknowledged in a robust manner,
mm-hmm.
Those hospitals are doing fine. Those doctor practices are doing fine, and those patients are doing fine.
Yeah, we had the mayor of, I think it was Burwell or Bellflower, North Carolina, on the program. He was a Republican, the mayor of his small rural town. They have a hospital that's closing down, and he marched from North Carolina. This Republican mayor marched from North Carolina to Washington, D.C., asking for North Carolina to expand Medicaid so that they could get their hospital back. It's incredible. I mean,
they did, and they came up with some really weak the community pushed them to get their hospital back. And they've really not solved their problem.
Yeah. Well, they've got you know, their own local Koch brothers version, and Art Pope, this billionaire who's kind of runs the state these days in North Carolina. It's very, very bizarre. Dr. George's Benjamin, anything that our listeners need to know about right now, anything that they need to be doing in response to this, or is this a matter of just hang on to your hats, let's see what happens?
Well, I think they ought to educate themselves, but I would encourage people to call their elected officials and tell them, listen, you know, say, I support the Affordable Care Act. Write letters to the editor. Get the media engaged. Make sure the public is well aware of the consequences of what might happen. And then should the court rule against the administration, they will be poised to be part of a grassroots movement to get the Congress to do whatever legislative action they need to do to make it right.
Yeah, and in my opinion, that legislative action is to drop the eligibility age for Medicare down to zero. What do you think?
Oh, you mean like Medicare for all?
Yeah.
You mean a rational?
Yeah, it was a radical idea that every other developed country in the world pretty much has done.
Well, that works.
Yeah. It's cheaper than what we've got. It's more effective than what we've got. It's simpler than what we've got.
Yeah.
You would think that, you know, that would be kind of a conservative idea, actually. You know?
Well, we have a conservative idea. It's called the Affordable Care Act.
It has
lots of conservative ideas in it.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that if it goes, I can assure you that people that support Medicare for all, we're pushing very hard for that to be our next stage of health reform.
Yeah, there you go. Dr. George's Benjamin, it looks like you've got to be someplace else. So thank you so much for dropping by. It's
Thanks, Tom.
A pleasure meeting you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for being a guest on our program today. Great to meet you. And back to your calls here. Ted in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Ted, what's on your mind today? Ted? Hello? Doesn't seem to be there. Okay, let's try Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. What's
on
your mind?
The thing is, what gets me, Tom, is if the Supreme Court overturns this here, I wonder what the Republican voters are going to do, the ones that were on Affordable Care Act. I wonder if they're going to still vote Republican. And you want to know, if they do overturn it, I wonder, you can bet your boots the Republicans are not even going to blink an eye, and they'll never suffer the consequences, and they won't get the blame. They'll blame Obama.
That's exactly what's going to happen, Donald. The official Republican line will be the Democrats wrote a bad bill. The Supreme Court called it out as a bad bill. It's all the Democrats' fault.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's what I was going to say. They're going to not take the vote. So you want to know something, Tom? I'm telling you, and I know you're going to think I'm a little cold. I hope they do overturn it. I want to see these people that put these people in office pay a price sometime, because apparently the very people they put in office don't seem to be paying the price. If I'm going to go down, I want to see them going down with me.
Yeah.
And I'm just so fed up with this whole thing. And I'm fed up with the Democratic politicians, too, for not speaking out a little bit more.
Well, a lot of them are. It's just that the media doesn't carry it. It's like Bernie is virtually holding press conferences every day. I mean, there's a bunch of people. Sherrod Brown was in here trying to get the message out. You're not seeing him on the national media. I mean, the national media just, you know, it's a corporate media. They have no interest in the voices that aren't going to make more money for, you know, big national corporations. So, anyhow, Donald, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Wes in Willits, California. Hey, Wes, got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Thanks for having me on. And I wanted to thank you for covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because there's been a complete media blackout of this with the exception of Ed Schultz. And I just want to request that you cover it even more.
Sure.
Because more people need to know about this. If I was you, I know there's a lot of stuff you have to do, but if I was you, I'd be devoting half the show every day to making people aware of this and to try to get people to call their representatives and say no to fast track, because this is the biggest mistake Obama is making right now. And the unions really need to start playing hardball. They need to go after Democrats that support this the way Grover Norquist goes after any Republican that dares raise taxes.
Yeah. I don't disagree. Wes, thanks a lot for the call. It's actually, at a certain level, I can't say I don't disagree, but because this is really an existential... I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an existential threat, not just to the United States, not just to our economy, but to our democracy. Anyhow, we'll be back in a few minutes. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So John Roberts, the ACA, King V. Burwell, Netanyahu, all kinds of stuff going on. Oh, and the Boehner is going to cave in and fund DHS. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live at the Families USA Radio Row in Washington, D.C., literally right across the street from the United States Supreme Court. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service for the news of the day. TalkRadioNews.com brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen is over in South Sudan right now, helping out those folks and hanging out with them. And free-don.org. Bob Ney on the line with us, Congressman, author of Sideswiped. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you're well.
I am good. Watching the speech by the Prime Minister of Israel to the Congress. He obviously, in the beginning of it, made it very, very clear that he had great words to say President Obama, but then throughout the speech, of course, went on to say that the policies of communicating with Iran did not set well with him.
Is that sort of like, you know, the kind of semi-classic abusive husband who's constantly proclaiming the love for his wife as he's beating the crap out of her?
He's beating her. Well, I watched the speech and he went back into 2,500 some years of history, actually, on Iran, and made, you know, some obviously some points about Iran's, you know, from when they took our hostages and their behavior. But it doesn't address the overlying issue of how do you come to terms with the nuclear Iran, which is the first time in 37-some years that anybody's actually been able to do it. And the unanswered question, Tom, frankly, I haven't seen a follow-up on the media. I tried prior to coming on your show of somebody asking him directly, you know, what alternative do you have if these talks stop and Iran heads towards a nuclear Iran?
Right. I'm assuming he didn't mention his having come here in 2002 and telling us that if we only invaded Iraq and took down Saddam Hussein, it would help the region.
Well, he didn't mention that, and he also didn't mention the fact that Mossad, the alternative to our CIA in Israel, a very top-notch intelligence gathering agency, in fact said that Iran was not within 1 year of the bomb, which is what the Prime Minister said about 3 years ago. Nancy Pelosi did exit before the speech was finished, but she did, you know, attend.
Does that qualify as walking out on a speech?
Well, it won't. It'll qualify as not being happy with yeah, you know, obviously with what was said. And look, the Prime Minister, as a lot of people may not be aware, is dead heat. He's a dead heat in the polls in Israel. So this is not just being debated here on our shores. It's also being debated over in Israel.
Right. Yeah.
I did want to mention that there is some grief for the sitting speaker, John Boehner, because we could take the actual podcast of your show last Tuesday where you and I spoke and we talked about the Friday deadline and just transpose it into today.
Right.
Where we have a Friday deadline.
Right.
Except for the fact that the speaker has now blinked in the sense that he has said, well, you know, this is the right thing to do. We're just going to have a clean vote. I would point out, under Congressional House rules, because of the fact that a conference committee of the Senate and House on this issue was defeated, meant that the Democratic side could have the right to bring up a vote on this bill anyway. Speaker Boehner knew that. He knew that would happen.
So it was a matter of either Nancy Pelosi slapping him upside the head or him slapping himself upside the head. He chose to go the latter.
That's correct. He chose to do that. So he's going to have a clean vote. He will pay a price, of course, for this with with some of his caucus, but it was really going to turn into a nightmare if he didn't do something. And the other story that I wanted to mention, because this was started by the lawyer, he's affiliated with the National Archives, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to recall his name. I think it's Baron, B-E-A-R-O-N, I guess it's pronounced. But he started the story about Hillary Clinton. And the one thing I wanted to note on this, because it's going viral, et cetera, but Colin Powell came out and said he also used personal email to communicate with American officials, ambassadors, and other leaders around the world. And I would point out that the actual law on this, if you look at the law, which I did.
November 2014.
That's right. This law came out in 2014, so there has been no violation of the law by Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And also, there's nothing in the articles today or yesterday that verify that encryption wasn't used by Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So it's very, very possible you can have encryption, especially at the level of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, anybody can have an encrypted email account if they want.
Right.
And beyond that, why is the media not pointing out that there are an estimated 5 million emails that were generated inside the White House? So, clearly when people were on federal property anyway, by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Karl Rove, that were running through this private server in Tennessee that was also the server that did the vote tabulations for the state of Ohio in 2004. But the guy who owned that server is now dead. The server's been scrapped. But, there's 5 million missing emails in the Bush administration. Nobody's talking about that.
That's correct. I was very familiar, of course, with that whole scenario with the man from Akron, Ohio, whose plane went down under some mysterious terms.
Yeah.
And people aren't mentioning also the fact that Hillary Clinton has turned over 55,000 pages of document, not turned over due to a subpoena, but turned it over in the normal course of business.
Right.
And
right.
Colin Powell, I think, statement, he came out today and said that he also did the same thing. In fact, Secretary of State Kerry would be the first Secretary of State that has used the government email and the first under the new regulations and law. So
right. Okay. Got about a half a minute left, Congressman. Any other hot news?
Well, no, just that, we're all watching the King versus Burwell case with the health care bill.
Yeah, that's going to be tomorrow here at the Supreme Court, and it's why we're doing the Radio Row from right across the street from the Supreme Court today and tomorrow with Families USA. You're absolutely right. That's going to be a big deal, whether or not the Supreme Court is going to liken Bush v. Gore, do something.
Very interesting, and also when Congress has made a mistake on language, FYI, the court sometimes tends to go into the clarification realm, which the administration is calling this a...
Yeah, the Chevron Doctrine. There you go. Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. We'll be back with more from FamiliesUSA.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, it's a truly historic day here in the United States. For the first time since the founding of our republic, a member of the opposition party has invited a foreign leader to address the Congress of the United States, specifically to criticize the President of the United States. Now, just think about that. For the first time in the history of our country, as far as I can tell, now maybe you know something I don't, but somehow I just, you know, I can't imagine James Madison inviting the British to come in and explain, you know, what happened with the War of 1812. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. I don't have any recollection of ever reading books about, you know, German politicians coming to the United States during World War I or World War II to address Congress. I mean, this is, can you imagine if the Democrats had done this to George Bush? Can you imagine the level of outrage if the Democrats had invited Hugo Chavez to address Congress, and he came in and he trashed Bush for saying, you know, and he came in and he said, you know, if you guys invade Iraq, it's going to be a horrible mistake. This is astonishing. Just astonishing to me. Meanwhile, this is interesting. The headline by Jason Easley over at PoliticusUSA.com. Boehner stunt backfires as NBC, CBS, and ABC do not televise Netanyahu's speech to Congress. So if the prime minister gives a speech and nobody hears, did he give a speech? So, like, you know, if a log falls in the forest or a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it actually happen? I don't know. It's just this is not something that would be happening if this president was anybody other than who he is, and I mean that just the way it sounds. The level of disrespect that the largely white Republican Party has used to treat this our first African American president is not just astonishing. It's un-American. Tim in Chicago. Hey Tim, what's on your mind today?
I've got to tell you, I feel the same way. I'm a conservative Republican, and I have never seen or can justify what they did. And I am very much a Benjamin Netanyahu supporter, but he should have known better as well. He should have paid far more respect to the office of the presidency. He was calling on America to make sure that they support Israel through, I mean, the death that Iran has definitely has decreed on Israel. I can understand his concerns. But there is diplomacy and respect and dignity that needs to be afforded our country and the office of our president. So
Well, and also there's the issue that you don't need to negotiate with your friends, but you do need to negotiate with your enemies. It's the only way that things move forward outside of war. I mean, these are basically the two ways that nations change their behavior. Is they either get their butts kicked in a war, or you know, they get brought in from the cold, like we're doing with Cuba right now too, which has got a whole bunch of Republicans all upset.
But Iran has declared war on Israel.
Absolutely
no question about that.
As has Saudi Arabia, and it still stands today. But we talked to Saudi Arabia.
That's true. I mean, he does. Netanyahu should have just used more prudence. That's what I'm not supportive in any way. I will contact every single one of the representatives that I do in these cases and express my outrage that the Republican Party cannot see the good that this president has done in many ways. I don't understand why you can't agree with your opposition party when they're right about something. It does not. I will not change to be a non-conservative, and I will not change to be a non-Republican. But to say that you are right about something, Tom, does not change me.
Yeah.
It just means I recognize what's correct and true.
Well, and it means you're an adult. That's one of the most adult things that anybody can do, is to say, you know, okay, I'm wrong and this guy is right on this particular issue, but, you know, I'm still who I am and this is what I believe. Or we just respectfully disagree, for that matter. You don't even have to acknowledge that somebody else is right. Tim, thank you for a very adult conversation and for the call. And thanks for listening to WCPT there in Chicago. Appreciate it. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind?
Yes, Professor, regarding Mr. Netanyahu addressing the United States Congress, I read a book by a gentleman named Max Blumenthal, and the title of this book is called Goliath. And after reading, it's a 400-page book, I read all of them. And after reading that book, I'd have to say that Mr. Netanyahu is a war criminal. You have to understand, Professor, that the Jews operate under what is called a settler state, not a democracy, as Mr. Netanyahu likes to promote. And there were people living there for thousands of years. I'm talking about the Palestinians. I want to give a shout-out to the Palestinians for helping us deal with the tear gas that was being thrown at us in Ferguson. But there's another book written by a guy called Garth Porter. It's called Manufactured Crisis. It relates to what's going on in Iran. This whole discussion about Iran being bad guys is being manufactured. We should remember that in 1953, which was a very good year, by the way, there was a coup that took place in that country. Why? Because they wanted to nationalize their resources. So the United States Central Intelligence Agency, and we're good at that, along with British Petroleum, decided to overthrow a democratically elected government. Okay, well, you know what's happened since that time. But you see, some of these things that are being just swept under the rug should be brought out, because people are operating under misconceptions. Mr. Netanyahu operates a very discriminatory government. Just ask the Palestinians. So I don't mean to start any trouble with Jewish people, but I would say read that book by Max Blumenthal before you offer any opinion on my boy Netanyahu. And
okay.
Thank you for taking my call, Professor.
You got it. Thank you, Morris. Appreciate the call. Tom in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today? I'm sorry, in Champaign, Illinois.
Oh, okay. Hi, Tom. My thing is, they haven't mentioned New World Order in quite some time, even though it was mentioned back by Herbert Walker Bush back in the 80s when I think, he just blurted it out. It's like they've already got the framework going for this stuff. And I think the elitists are, going to keep the pressure up and get what they want.
Yeah, you want the end game of the new world order is Shaft of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's just turn everything over, at least control and regulation of everything, over to transnational corporations and billionaires. And it's, we are at this really, really existential pivot point in the United States, and with some very, very large issues that we have to figure out what we're going to do with. Tom, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Jeff, listening on Sirius in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's interesting that you call it an adult conversation when people agree with you. I heard the Netanyahu speech, and for the first 15 minutes, all he did was praise President Obama and the American people.
Right.
And the point that I'd like to make is one of Prime Minister Netanyahu is a leader. Mm-hmm. He is a fierce leader. President Obama is a political hack, a coward, and a liar.
Really?
Sure, you're going to call me immature,
Jeff,
and this and that.
Are you seriously saying this? We're out of time.
It's fairly evident.
Okay, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Nice try. I don't think it's going to fly with our audience, but nice try. Certainly not going to fly with me. Calling Obama a hack and Netanyahu that's 15 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting live from the Families USA Talk Radio, Radio Row. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the FamiliesUSA.org Radio Row. And Doc and Max Richman is with me today, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, NCPSSM.org. And we've been interviewing doctors all morning. I could call you a doctor, too. You have a doctor.
Juris doctor.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Okay. Max, welcome back.
It's Thank you so much, Tom.
And give me your take on, and I should say, you're a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, 16-year veteran of Capitol Hill, and the president and CEO here of the National Committee. What are the issues and concerns at the front of your mind right now?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of myths about the program as it impacted Medicare. But the fact is that there are tremendous improvements in the Medicare program by virtue of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Improvements in treatments, improvements in out-of-pocket costs, improvements in the solvency of the trust fund. All of those are likely to disappear if the Supreme Court, in effect, guts the Affordable Care Act. And let me just mention quickly those improvements. Since the Affordable Care Act became law, for the first time ever under the Medicare program, a beneficiary can get all types of preventive screenings, cancer, diabetes, mammogram, colonoscopy, with no out-of-pocket cost. Hmm. An annual wellness visit with a physician with no out-of-pocket cost. Dramatically reduced prices for out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs. And the solvency of the Medicare program, we're always concerned about that, is extended for 7 years. All of that could disappear. All of that is at stake, and that's, to answer your question specifically, that's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, it's a very serious concern. The United States Supreme Court is, in my opinion, wandering into a territory that they have no business wandering into.
Not the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is Bush v. Gore all over again, yeah. I believe. You know, this is something it's not part of their purview. I mean, you're an attorney. You would have a better understanding and perspective on this than I would. What are the possible outcomes here, and how do you see them playing out in terms of healthcare policy?
Well, I think ideally what we would hope to see is that the court, by whatever margin, conclude that the Affordable Care Act, subsidies in the Affordable Care Act, whether they're state exchanges or the federal exchanges, are lawful.
Right.
And I think it's clear from the testimony, the debate, the record, the legislative record. You know, and it was a tortured trip,
yeah.
If you remember.
Oh, yeah.
The bill passed in the Senate by one vote. I mean, a lot of arms were twisted, and it barely became law. But there was no discussion about this from any committee staff, from a Congressional Budget Office, Office of Management and Budget. And there were some pretty intelligent experts that looked at this all the way through. This was never an issue.
Right.
It was assumed that these exchanges could be subsidized regardless of whether they were state or federal. And I think that the court is incumbent upon the court to look at some of that intent very, very closely.
Yeah. It seems that the hope is that the court will apply the Chevron doctrine, where they explicitly, in 84, I think it was, Chevron versus FEC, or...
I think that's right.
Yeah. The court came out and explicitly said, just because, now this is me paraphrasing, but just because a law was written poorly, was constructed poorly, doesn't mean that it has to be wiped off the books by a court. If the court can determine the intent of the authors of the bill, and even if there's something in the bill that contradicts the outcome of that intent, we go with the intent, not the specific language that might have been an error.
But that was a different composition of the court. We're looking at a different court now, and I'm not sure that logic will prevail. I hope you're right, but. I'm not sure.
That was before the court was run by crazy right-wing whack jobs. And
well, you said you said
I'll say it. Yes. I noticed here a couple of things that Sean had mentioned. The National Committee's Eleanor's Hope Initiative.
Yeah, you know, we have spent years defending Social Security. Most recently, from President Bush's privatization efforts. You remember that?
2005. I got my political capital, you know, yeah.
Exactly. Well, you remember it. I remember it because we were sitting in our office, in our little boardroom off the Capitol Hill, the day after President Bush was reelected, and he walked out to the podium. We were just curious what he was going to say. And he said, I've earned political capital. I'm going to use it to privatize Social Security. Right. We about fell out of our chairs. We knew how our work cut out for us. But we followed him wherever he went. We didn't have Air Force One, but we followed him as best we could, either in person or on radio, newspaper ads. And the National Committee to Preserve Social Security, I think, was one of the leaders in that effort to stop that movement. Yeah. But
he was hell-bent for leather for that. I mean, that was the single thing that he ran for Congress on in the 70s and lost.
Absolutely. Maybe he was trying to redeem that loss.
I think so.
But he failed in that effort. And I think that, I think that it may take a few more years, but eventually Social Security, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act will all be looked at as part of the fabric of our society. And it'll be very difficult to mess with those programs.
Don't you think that they're looked at as the fabric of our society by the vast majority of Americans?
Absolutely.
Right now?
You know, we have done polls and surveys for the last few years by very reputable pollsters. The vast majority of Americans, young, old, middle-aged, Democrat, Republican, Independent, support Social Security and want to improve it. The Boost Social Security campaign that we've embarked on, the Eleanor's Hope that you mentioned, which would improve benefits for women who live longer, have lower benefits, shorter work histories, have lower benefits, depend on it more. We need to improve the program. It's time to do that.
I'm with you, Max. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
That was Max Richman. Richman?
You got it?
Yeah, the President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security, ncpssm.org. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Radio Row, put together by FamiliesUSA.org. And in the shadow of the Supreme Court, we are literally next door to the Supreme Court, where tomorrow they will be hearing oral arguments in the case King v. Burwell, which is an attempt by hardcore right-wingers to destroy Obamacare. It's that simple. By the way, over at Democratic Underground, I love it when people, you know, put these things up. War is a racket has posed some great quotes from FDR. I just have to share a couple of these with you. The first one came from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. This is a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 32nd president of the United States, as I recall. The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual or by a group. I just let that sink in for a minute. The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power, like the Koch brothers raising $1 billion, to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism. It's the ownership of government by an individual or by a group. He goes on to say, we must be especially aware of that small group of selfish men who would clip the wings of the American eagle in order to feather their own nests. And here's a great one. Two great ones. These have to do with the minimum wage, which was first passed. I mean, first proposed, first passed. It didn't even exist before Franklin Roosevelt. And back then, you know, a minimum wage of $7-$8 a week was a big deal. He said, do not let any calamity howling executive with an income of $1,000 a day tell you that a wage of $11 a week is going to have a disastrous effect on all American industry. And then he also said, no business which depends for its existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country. And by living wages, I mean more than a bare subsistence level. I mean the wages of a decent living. Where is FDR when we need him? And we need him. Amazing. Amazing. Dave in South Range, Michigan. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the King versus Burwell case.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't the plaintiffs in a Supreme Court case supposed to show some sort of damage?
Yes.
To have standing?
In any kind of case, yes. In order to have standing, when you go before a court, you have to demonstrate that you are harmed or a victim. You can't just litigate something because of your opinion.
Well, how are they damaged by Congress providing affordable health care to the American people?
That's a very good question, and the assertions of damage have been by these very, very cherry-picked plaintiffs have been just radically, totally, thoroughly debunked by people who look at the case. This is a case that should not be before the Supreme Court. It's just that simple. This is the five right-wing justices on the Supreme Court doing the same thing they did in Bush v. Gore, which is going way beyond what the Supreme Court should do. And it's amazing. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. Good to hear from you. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay, great. I know we're talking about the healthcare thing, but I just wanted to shift gears for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to talk about Netanyahu. To be honest with you, that's just a stall tactic by him and the Republicans to stop us from actually coming up with an agreement with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest blow to the Republican Party today that I haven't heard people really talking about is General Petraeus actually agreeing to, I guess, to a one felony count. And I know this has to be a blow to those Republicans that were also trying to consider him for running for president.
Yeah.
You know, they all have failed leaders. I'm looking at Marco Rubio, too. The reason why he's mad, and take it from me, I live here in Miami. The reason why I think he's mad President Obama has opened up talks with Cuba is because he wanted to do it.
Sure.
He wanted to come.
Yeah,
to
he wanted to do the Nixon goes to China thing.
Exactly. And that was his way in.
Yeah.
And slowly but surely, all of their best and brightest are falling to the side because they all have all type of problems as well, you know.
Yep.
They want to harp that they have the best party, and it's really us. It's really the hardworking American people, this Democrats and independents, that's fighting these people and trying to stop us. Trying to stop them from taking us to war.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Charles. Good point. Brandy in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Brandy, what's up?
Well, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
I have a question for you. It's been 40 years since I've been in civics. But with Netanyahu speaking before our Congress today, a joint session, if I'm to understand this correctly, isn't that at the very least sedition?
You could argue
and on a
that...
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Just a personal sidebar. The Republic fell on January 20th of 1981, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
day Reagan was inaugurated.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Brandy. That was the beginning of, not the end of the Republic, but the beginning of some major damage to the Republic. The other major damage that was done was in 1972 when Richard Nixon put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. I don't think that Netanyahu committed sedition. He's a foreign leader. He's not beholden to this country. I do think that you could build a very strong case that what John Boehner did in negotiating this and making this happen behind the back and over the objection of the executive branch of the president is seditious. That said, the sedition laws have a fairly high bar, and ultimately it would end up before the Supreme Court. In fact, very rapidly it would, because it would be an interbranch debate. And so it's not going to happen. It's just going to be up to the American people to realize what's going on. So anyhow, Brandy, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Lee in Veronia, Oregon. Hey, Lee, what's up?
I wanted to mention, well, first I wanted to thank you for bringing up the origins of the word homeland, because I'm in my 80s, and I recall the word, and every time I hear it, it makes me cringe.
Yeah. Yeah. For people who don't know what you're talking about, we during the commercial breaks here, for folks on Free Speech TV, we've been playing a clip of a daily take that I did a while back where I was talking about how the word homeland was used by the Nazis to describe Germany, to try to create a this is our country thing, and it's
racial identification.
Yeah, racial identity, exactly. And it's just crazy that we're using that word to describe America. The only people in North America who can call this continent their homeland are the Native Americans.
Yeah. One other thing. You talk about how corporations have taken over radio and TV,
yeah,
newspapers too, all media. But in the 70s, early 70s, my husband and I did polling, which was required by the FCC at that time for all radio and television stations to run a poll. I don't think it was every year. I think it was every other year of their local listening areas. And the poll was a standard telephone random poll.
Yeah. Right.
Gender and age and all of that. And had two elements. One was the general population, the other was business and government. So in these two areas, we did telephone polling to find out how people were satisfied or dissatisfied with the broadcasting.
Right. That's because back in that era, stations had to prove to the FCC every year or every other year that they deserved to have their license renewed because they were using the public airwaves. Those public airways got auctioned off in 96 with the signing of the Telecommunications Act. And, it's never been the same.
No. I was really sorry to see that go. It didn't matter for us. That was just a sideline that we were doing.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story with us, Lee. It's nice to hear from you. Thank you very much for watching. Fred in Lacey, Washington. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today?
I was wondering, Tom, if you're familiar with the Logan Act.
The Logan Act says that you or I, if we were to call up Mr. Netanyahu and start negotiating U.S. foreign policy with him, we could go to jail. It's against the law to negotiate with foreign governments unless you are authorized by the government of the United States to do so.
But wouldn't members of Congress be considered unauthorized people as well?
Well, I think it would turn on the word negotiation. The problem is that Netanyahu and John Boehner are not negotiating. They're not, what they're trying to do is destroy a president. And they're trying to deprive him of any legacy whatsoever. It's what the Republicans have been doing ever since the original caucus room conspiracy. And Kevin McCarthy was on Meet the Press over the weekend on Sunday, and nobody even bothered to, Chuck Todd didn't even bother to ask him, hey, didn't you, swear on your honor that you would destroy the Obama presidency? The Logan Act, I don't think it works here, but I think the sentiment of it certainly does, Fred. And thanks for calling and mentioning it. Great to hear from you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, Senior Counsel with Covington & Burlington, big law firm here in D.C. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the shadow of the Supreme Court building. We're literally right next door here in Washington, D.C., where tomorrow they will hear oral arguments on King v. Burwell. Shano is going to be over there listening to the bozo in chief and others, and we'll come back and report to us on the program tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to that and to Shane's ever insightful analysis of what's going on. Ray in Van Buren, Arkansas. Hey, Ray, you're on the air. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
It's good to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to say that the reason that President Obama and the Obama administration is holding these talks, these P6 talks with the Iranian leaders, is because they don't completely trust them. But at the same time, Netanyahu has serious credibility problems of his own. And before I get to my main points concerning Iran, which he covered today in his speech before a joint session of Congress, Netanyahu said in 2002, before a joint session of Congress, he said that Iraq had centrifuges, quote, the size of washing machines, which turned out to be utterly false, but nevertheless helped to lay the groundwork for a war in Iraq that was based upon false pretenses.
Yep. Netanyahu has either lied to us a number of times or gotten just an astonishing amount of bad information over the years.
And the thing that makes me think is that if it's either one, his credibility is still lacking. Because in 1992, when he was then parliamentary speaker, he spoke before the Israeli Knesset, and he told them then that Iran was 3 to 5 years away from a bomb. 3 years passed. Right. Turned out to be false.
Yeah.
In 95, in his book, Fighting Terrorism, Netanyahu again repeated that unproven assertion that turned out to be false,
right,
that Iran was 3 to 5 years away from getting a bomb. And in 2006 and in 2012, he again repeated those assertions that Iran was close to getting the bomb. And in 2012, which I just stated, when he spoke before the United Nations, he said that Iran was around the 70% threshold to getting a nuclear warhead, which requires 90% enrichment. But we just found out this year through cable wires that were leaked that Israeli intelligence knew that to be false.
Right.
So I can't figure out why Boehner would want someone like Netanyahu, who, although he's a powerful force for his people and he's trying to speak what he thinks is best for him, why would he invite someone whose credibility has been utterly shot like Netanyahu's has? I mean, Netanyahu's credibility has just had so many holes poked into him, and it's been self-inflicted.
There's really two questions that you presented, Ray. Number one, why is Netanyahu doing this, and why has he been doing this since the early 90s, always pointing at Iran and always saying Iran is going to get us, number one? And number two, why would he be essentially lying to us? And actually, Ray, my next guest just showed up. You're Ambassador Eisenstadt? Oh, welcome. Here, have a seat. Come on over. Ray, I'm going to have to pick this up tomorrow. If you can give me a call back and remind me of the topic, I do have two very emphatic opinions. One, I think Netanyahu is doing what George W. Bush did with 9/11. You know, he's trying to become Superman. He needs a Lex Luthor, and so his Lex Luthor has been Iran. And with regard to Boehner, he just wanted anybody who would trash President Obama. Anyhow, thank you very much for the call, Ray. Ambassador, we're on the air. I'm sorry. And Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt is with us. He's the senior counsel at Covington & Burlington, a law firm here in Washington, D.C., former U.S. ambassador to the European Union. Covington's website, COV.com.
And President Carter's chief White House domestic policy advisor, where I worked on national insurance.
Well, thank you. Thank you for letting us know. In fact, I think that I know that I've got that in here someplace. But in any case, tell me you worked with President Carter on health care policy.
Yes, very much so. I was his chief domestic policy advisor, and I negotiated an agreement with Senator Kennedy in 1979, in which we agreed on the financing, the phasing over years. Senator made a number of concessions, as we did as well. And then when I came back with the agreement, the president's economic advisor said, you know, we are living in an era of very high inflation and interest rates. A new entitlement program may disturb the markets even more. Go back to the senator and say, we have to build in a provision that a president could restrain a step from coming into effect if we couldn't afford it economically. Mm-hmm. And I knew that was a poison pill, and he wouldn't accept it. We then came back with a $17 billion, talking about 1980, that's a lot of money then and now, first phase program, which would have been catastrophic coverage or and covering all children.
Right.
And the senator said, no, it's got to be comprehensive. So we missed a historic opportunity when we had a heavily Democratic Congress. Now we finally have it, and the Supreme Court could potentially unravel the whole thing. But I would like, if I may, to talk about my experience for 2.5 years as President Clinton's ambassador to the European Union.
Please, we have just 1 minute.
That gave me the real opportunity to see the benefit of universal coverage, how it took away the fear factor, how people knew they could rely on having insurance. And those who say, well, Europe is willing to spend a lot more. You know, we spend 16% of our gross domestic product on health insurance, and we have spotty coverage, and it'll be even worse if the Supreme Court goes the wrong way. They have universal coverage in Europe, and they spend 8% of their GDP.
Right, half.
So I saw this personally. I saw my own cousin who visited when she got sick go into a hospital in the suburbs of Paris and get free coverage. So we, as a country, should establish, and we've been trying since 1948 with Harry Truman, we now have the coverage, although still not as expansive as in Europe. And I pray that the Supreme Court will not unravel what is left of it.
Stuart Eisenstadt, very nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for dropping by today. And thank you for being with us today for these 3 hours. We will be back tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Tag your ad. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.